Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of the environment, food, and health, talking about policy, media, popular understanding, and what's going on in our role as citizens and with our government that determines everything that goes on in our interactive world. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between you and your family's personal well-being and the well-being of our community, our region, our society, as well as the ecological stability of planet Earth. There are many different things that go on in our interconnected world that can either promote our health and planetary health and well-being or undermine it. And each week on the show, we talk with different experts, thought leaders, advocates, farmers, authors, scientists, filmmakers, policymakers, journalists, and a whole host of other people about everything going on in our world that coalesces to create our life, our quality of life, our health, and our well-being, as well as the well-being of our society and our ecosystem. So each week on the show, this is what we discuss. Today, we have a really terrific guest upcoming for you, and I'm going to be doing a short introduction because, you know, when I began covering health, food, and then a little bit later, the environment. And for many years, people were like, well, what's, you know, that's a kind of broad area. And yes, it is. At the same time, these things are, you know, these facets of our world are all interconnected. And even though for reasons of economics, branding, specialization, et cetera, we kind of tend to see these things in separate niches or think about them separately or espouse one over another. I have, you know, for quite a while been a generalist, and I've always seen the ball as interconnected, and I think more and more we all are. One of the things that I've covered fossil fuel extraction for over a decade, you know, which affects this form of energy use, affects our environment, it affects, you know, our children's future. But food also plays a really important role on so many levels. Recently, you know, over the last couple of years, only people are really facing up to and beginning to understand the way that our plans, you know, our plans as a society, as an ecosystem for how we grow food has profound impact not only on our own individual health and well-being, but also on the planet itself. Because some forms of agriculture are implicated in climate destabilization, and others are actually climate restorative, as is regenerative agriculture, which I've probably covered on this show over the last several years, I don't know, dozens of times, as well as written articles in some of the publications that where I report, including Truth Out, Common Dreams, and in the past, Alternate and Huffington, EcoWatch, as well as currently in Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. So, you know, now food, most recently, is really becoming a theme in politics. It used to be kind of don't go there, woman's topic, or something farmers were interested in, but we really have a lot of activity on the food front, you know, in our political life today, because as a society, we have to change course and make certain decisions and not just leave it to industry to dictate what kinds of foods will be grown or how, you know, how agriculture is done when we all have to live with either the negative effects or the positive effects. This past week, Senator Bernie Sanders, a Democratic Party candidate for president, spoke at an Iowan Organic Farmers Presidential Forum, and it's always been conceived that the Green New Deal, the highly popular Green New Deal, which is something that Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Edwin Markey brought out My God, it's like almost a year ago this coming February, has been on the agenda as food, that food and agriculture would play an important role in the total and comprehensive Green New Deal that is being proposed and articulated, and which, I cover regularly and on this show, and will continue to do so, and have some terrific upcoming programs on that, in fact. But it hasn't, that particular area of the Green New Deal has not been that spelled out so far in the presidential campaign. But that's now changing because Iowa is one of, the first primary states coming up. And so all the candidates are descending upon Iowa. And in speaking with Iowan organic farmers at a presidential forum, President, a presidential forum, Senator Bernie Sanders really articulated his vision. And in fact, this is not just something he's adopted recently. Vermont, which he has long represented as senator, is a farming state, and he has long been a champion of organic food, regenerative agriculture, labeling foods for GMOs. And toxins, and promoting a healthy food supply for everyone. And so he really laid forth his complete vision for this in this recent presidential forum. And, as someone who's reported on, and you can go into the archives here, connect the dots, and find numerous interviews with regenerative agriculture cultural proponents and farmers and thought leaders and organizers, and find what for them have been defined as the critical areas, building up the soil, drawing down carbon into the soil. We have entire programs on this. But for this to really have a major impact on climate, it needs to be made economically sustainable. It needs to not be happening on the margins of a food system devoted to toxic pesticides and monocrops and soil depletion, that creates profit growing a few products, but really undermines our soil, causes desertification, and does not produce healthy food in the quantities we need to feed people in our society. So, Senator Sanders really articulated how, in if there, in a Sanders administration, he would redo and, kind of create a system change that really supports the kind of regenerative agriculture we need, which we'll be learning more about on today's show from our upcoming guest. And in the aftermath of that, a prominent farmers group have endorsed Sanders for president. And this is all coming up before Iowa. There's been another aspect or, kind of consideration or dynamic in food that's also come to light this past week, thanks to articles, blog, kind of public statements. And I actually had the honor to hear Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York speak about this in person at a forum in her community in Queens for her district, for the people who she represents. Because the Trump administration has put into place what many people feel is a very dire new rule that would see hundreds of thousands of people losing access to food stamps. So, on the one hand, we have some people trying to feed people and other trying to, other folks on the political spectrum trying to deny people access, poor people who really depend on food stamps access. And Representative Ocasio-Cortez really pointed out that she herself had personally experienced what it is to have to rely on food stamps. This occurred for her family when her father died young at the age of 48. And, of course, we have billionaires running for office, billionaires behind the scenes trying to, you know, kind of put spending advertising dollars to promote certain candidates. But we don't have that many people who really represent more, you know, have had a life experience that represents the very large number of Americans who are hit by the economic hardships created by our social structures. And, you know, Cortez very movingly said that, you know, she was a student at the time, and if this kind of rule had been put in place then, she said, we might have starved. And now many people will. This is a quote from her. It's shameful how the GOP works overtime to create freebies for the rich while dissolving lifelines of those who need it most. And, you know, of course, they have language around why they're claiming this is okay. And AOC really kind of got down into the weeds and explained why they're carving out the people who would not be affected or would be affected by this rule change is really, you know, does not represent the reality on the ground. Cortez said, the rule ignores the reality of American life. And she pointed out, you know, the tremendous hardship that these people at the top are kind of visiting on ordinary Americans. And so that's actually something that we're going to have a future guest unpack a bit more for us. And I think it's really important to understand that, but, you know, some of us are, you know, kind of concerned, and rightly so, about the quality of food because, you know, some doctors have been on this show and said that more toxins enter our bodies through food than anything else. But, you know, we're also, there are many people in the society who, need access to any food at all and need public assistance to get that because the economic playing field has been kind of weighted against them, really, is the only way to put it. So in any case, you know, you're going to be hearing more about food, and we're going to be hearing more about food on today's show, and I'm so delighted to have our upcoming guests with us today. And now I'd like to welcome and first introduce our guest for today's show. He is Reginaldo Hazlett-Morroquin, a native Guatemalan who began working on economic development projects with indigenous communities in 1988. He served as a consultant for the UN's Bureau for Latin America and as an advisor to the World Council of Indigenous Peoples. Reginaldo Hazlett-Morroquin migrated to the U.S. in 1992, was a founding member of the Fair Trade Federation in 1994, was the director of the Fair Trade Program at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy from 1995 to 1998. He has been widely recognized for his service and his serving on a whole host of organizations that protect the earth and a healthy food supply and people and animals. He was a founding and steering committee member of Regeneration International, of the Regeneration Agricultural Alliance, and you know, we covered regenerative agriculture a lot on this program, but Reginaldo is somebody who has both enacted that through growing, but also who has built and helped other organizations build the structures and systems that allow this to be scaled up and to happen in many places. Reggie has an agronomy degree from the National Central School of Agriculture, and as well as he's a graduate in business administration. And he currently lives and farms in Minnesota with his wife and kids. And is the systems and strategy officer at Main Street Project, a co-owner of and co-founder of Regeneration Farms, LLC. And in his own book, In the Shadow of Green Man, he describes his journey from poverty and hunger to food insecurity and hope. Currently, Reginaldo Haslett-Moroquin is the president and CEO at Regenerative Agriculture Alliance in Minnesota, and I am deeply honored to invite, you know, to welcome him here to Connect the Dots. Welcome, Reggie. So, you know, Reginaldo, you have been a champion of regenerative agriculture for quite some time. Can you give our listeners just like a snapshot description of what we're talking about when we say regenerative agriculture and why it's so needed?
Sure enough. Yes, this is something that is going to depart from the traditional understanding that we now have acquired in the common media and in the dominant talking points out there in terms of regenerative. Here's what I want to depart from is the fact that regenerative became a buzzword in recent years, and as a buzzword is very misinterpreted and misunderstood in many settings. Most of the so-called regenerative agriculture and initiatives out there are actually not grounded on a full understanding of what it means to be regenerative. And really, we don't even have to have it as a market name or anything like that. Regenerative for me, growing up in the northern rainforest of Guatemala, was really simply a indigenous way of thinking, acting with, and working with nature. And in a regenerative setting, you really don't decide what it is that is going to go into the land. You let the land decide that for you. And yes, you modify it to deliver certain things you want, but always from the land perspective, not from our colonized, imposition-based, you know, extractive, you know, approach. And so within that context, I like to say that, for example, I wouldn't consider monocropping, you know, corn and soybeans to be possible regeneratively. Why? Because by definition, regenerating a space means regenerating the original blueprint that the earth developed over geological time for that specific area. So if I were to put corn and soybeans in the Midwest, for example, and do it under a regenerative indigenous-based approach, I would limit it to a very small blueprint and impact, and I will concentrate on the impact on the land on those species that are specific and native and indigenous and to that geology and that ecology. And so that is fundamentally a very different departing point that I come from. And working with regenerative poultry, the objective isn't the poultry. Poultry cannot be regenerative by itself. In our case, it's regenerative because we have brought the whole system all the way from how the grain is produced and back to this concept of if we're going to produce grain in the Midwest, how we're going to do it to be able to keep the chain of custody all the way from that far end of the spectrum all the way through, which includes raising the chickens in a free-range system and all of that, but also raising them in a habitat that is natural or more aligned or the closest modern version that we can come up with to the geoevolutionary blueprint of the poultry habitat, and that is the jungle. So we have, for example, in the Midwest, brought back the hazelnut as a centerpiece of poultry, regenerative poultry, the elderberry plantations, which are, you know, those species are native to the Midwest and most of the United States territory, by the way. And then above that, building that jungle-like structure with trees, different kinds of species, all of them selected to be highly valuable as food, as fiber, as timber, oh, and energy and so on. But that is what the concept of regenerative means to me. And basically, from a scientific and agronomical perspective, I don't consider myself, as a farmer, as an engineer in agriculture, I don't consider myself a producer. Production is not something that we do. That's something that nature does, but it does it in the context of energy transformation. from non-edible into edible energy. And when we actually look at it from that indigenous perspective, then we notice and really quickly start putting in very sophisticated science into focusing on turning energy from non-edible into edible. And when you look at it that way, then you end up with most of the energy that you transform in any given space being non-edible. In general, we are harvesting, and we need to be harvesting, between maybe 20, 30, up to 40% of the energy that is transformed in the space. That's what comes out in the form of food, whether it's nuts or carrots or chicken or eggs. The rest of it is non-edible, and that non-edible energy is what goes back into the space, into the soil, to feed the biology and to become the system that then feeds the next generation of energy transformation on the next cycle. And those cycles are made, you know, in nature, are happening all the time. Even in the winter, in the dead of winter in Minnesota, there is biological activity deeper in the soil. There is a whole system that nature has created to deal with that, and then come spring, all of that gets bumped up again, and the processes take off. Managing that is what regenerative is about, and in a regenerative system, all you need is the energy that exists in the ecosystem. You don't need any manufactured inputs, and we are not there yet in the regenerative conversation, and it's something that I'm trying to bring heavily into this conversation so that we can start actually creating the world we want.
That's fantastic. You know, I just can't resist asking this question because, you know, we've talked about the Green New Deal on this program multiple times. And, you know, one of the important components of that, and I've reported on Standing Rock and other things related to our indigenous communities here in the U.S. But one of the things that where I haven't seen that dot connected, as you just did, is in understanding the idea and the difference and the distinction between what it is to colonize a land, which is what happened when Western European peoples came to this continent and proceeded, and what it is to colonize the earth, and what that represents in terms of a shift in values. And, you know, I'd love to hear your take on that a little more, because it's a really whole different way of thinking for a number of reasons. And one of them, of course, is the fact that, as you mentioned in what you just said, this is thinking ahead to future generations and what will be growing and producing for them. And that's a big difference from the way we are accustomed to thinking about agriculture and industry and many different values in today's culture. So I'd love to hear you unpack the idea of what colonization is a little bit more.
Yes, I believe that, you know, when you look at the historical behavior of Native American communities and the Aztec and the Mayan and the Incas and so on all over the world, they were also colonizers. So the idea mm-hmm. that Christopher Columbus initiated the colonization of the Americas, that's not true. That doesn't mean that he didn't create a massive disruption and disrupted mm-hmm. a whole culture. And that disruption of the culture was really the most damaging thing that mm-hmm. Christopher Columbus and their followers did. Christopher Columbus himself and his generation and the previous, I don't know how many dozen generations, they were already colonized themselves. It didn't start with them. It started way back, that whole process. And in fact, it is the colonization history from, you know, hundreds, 100,000 years probably, if we go back far enough, at least 70,000 or so that we actually have documented evidence of with human remains. But the colonization started back then, and it didn't start with, you know, this massive capacity we have now of manipulating the mind, you know, the psychological operations that corporations and governments run now at a scale unthinkable just a few decades ago. But it was still happening, even though most of the world was not impacted yet by humans, and it wasn't until recently that we developed the actual machinery to do that. We were already colonizing small village after small village and all of that. That's when the virus actually hit us, and we began to move in that direction. Now, the difference between, say, Native communities in the United States versus Native communities from Europe that were actually coming here to colonize this region is that they were so much more advanced in the machinery and the capacity and the organization of the takeover. They even had processes for establishing laws and so on that would give them ownership and control over the territory and the people within it and so on. Now, one thing those groups didn't have, and they resisted, and they even publicly executed, you know, pioneers who would join the Native Americans because they found themselves literally what I call mentally decolonized when they were exposed to the Native American way. What this group didn't have and resisted was the continuous decolonization of their mind. It's like a permanent detox that you would do now with glyphosate and all of that in the atmosphere. You can detox, but you have to keep doing it consistently so it doesn't, you know, take over your body and makes you sick. Sickness. I mean, I think the colonized mentality is a mental illness. It's like greed. It's also a mental illness. And this new population coming into this country was already mentally ill. That's why they could kill, maim, and destroy with a very specific purpose and, you know, without the resentment that would normally make you stop. That was already taken out, desensitized out of those populations. And we keep doing that now, except we do it on a mass scale through games of war and all kinds of stuff going on. But the Native cultures, and the reason the disruption of the Native culture is really where the focus was through the boarding schools and all of that. The culture was really clearly understood because the Native communities had a detox, natural social detox process. And that happened because we had a deep connection to the natural world, and that was our detox strategy. Even though the Native community were trying to colonize each other and all of that, they did it under a different way because they had that detoxification and that kind of inoculant, which was basically grounded on connecting to the way the world actually works, not the way we want to structure it so we can extract everything that it has. That's the big difference. We really don't understand colonization because we never looked at it as a mental illness. When we see it as a mental illness, then you can start seeing how it actually crawled all the way through the lizard brain components of our evolutionary process, and then landed at where we are right now, unable to reverse the calamity of climate and all of that, because fundamentally, The climate crisis is the result of the colonizing of the mind and the fact that we have to freaking colonize everything we see in front of us. That is really the problem. And so we can do a lot of reversal through regenerative agriculture, sure enough, but we have to bring back the inoculant, in this case, the indigenous cultural values that keep us from going over that age that where there is no return. And now we have built enough machinery, political systems, manipulation of elections and all of that, enough that turning it back has become very difficult. Is that culture that initiated thousands of years ago? That's what we are up against. Climate change is just one of the consequences of that. And without changing some of that at a larger scale, some of that culture, we really can't fix climate change. And it is going to take us with it. It's going to render a large portion of the Earth inhabitable. And because if we continue with this colonized mentality, we will end up with very small portions of the Earth that are livable. And in that space, you know, the most powerful, the ones with the biggest armies, are the ones who would have hegemony. And in fact, we're already seeing that start to shape up like that in the radicalization of the violence and the incorporation of, you know, larger militaries into the current setting and using, you know, weaponizing, you know, social media and all of that to create the further disruption. And all of that is really, is this massive system that we have created, and we just don't seem to get a grasp of what it has done, what it can do to the future, And especially, we don't have the will anymore. Just like an addict doesn't have the many times the will to reverse their own addiction, we are kind of in the same thing, except this is a societal-wise global thing that it's really depressing when you actually spell it out like that and you realize the magnitude of the challenge. But on the other hand, there is an uproaring and a grassroots-based reaction to that right now. People are confused as to what it's going to take to reverse this. And of course, we are being manipulated again. You know, the term regenerative agriculture has been already whitewashed by a lot of corporate systems that have no interest in regenerative ag, but can see how it's grabbing the attention of the public and they want to capitalize on that. That's the wrong reason to get into this, because regenerative agriculture and agroforestry or agroecology, those are real solutions and they should be held with indigenous integrity so that we can use that field and that whole area of scientific advancements and so on and understanding of the world so that we can use that as a really potent detox. And I see the younger people actually, you know, wanting that detoxification, and they're willing to do what it takes, including forgetting about, you know, the money and about the power and ownership, or not, you know, or balancing out their urge for that drug so that they can start to detox. And I see the next generation and some of them already currently living and fighting for it, you know, Greta and all these younger people really trying to sort out what does it mean to decolonize our mind. Even though they're not calling it that, they're looking for an inoculant. They're looking for a detox procedure that can actually put us back in relationship to the earth where we are supposed to be, and not this virus that is eating it up and is going to run out of our body. And, you know, Elon Musk already talking about colonizing Mars. That's exactly the viral instinct, you know. So a virus eats up the body, and when it's done, it depopulates itself and it goes and looks for another body. And that's kind of that mentality we are seeing dominating from the rich and powerful in the world. And it's such a shame.
Thank you. My goodness, that was just such a beautiful, holistic vision of what we're actually dealing with. And it's so important for that to be articulated because, you know, one of the things that our reductive science, reductive agriculture and industry and, you know, and media does is break things down into tiny fragments so that, you know, you're holding some piece of the problem, whether it's Trump or Putin or whatever it might be, some small fragment that you become fixated on. And then you basically, the mind almost shrinks as part of the illness, and people lose the capacity to get a holistic picture. And what you've just described is really a very full and complete holistic image of the interactive, systemic, personal, social, and, you know, biological, ecological ailment and what has gone awry, and, you know, how to recognize it as the prelude to, you know, doing things in systems, in ways that reestablish that natural harmony to bring it back. So could you, you know, talk a little bit more about some of the initiatives with which you're involved and how you can foresee a meaningful shift occurring through these means if, you know, a certain number of these helpful restorative ways and initiatives unfold?
Absolutely. Yeah, one of the reasons, you know, I came into this world of regenerative agroecology field through the poultry eyes is because, you know, I needed to see where I could have my best opportunity to make a lifetime contribution. And you still have to reduce your approach and focus it. You can't really take the whole system on because it's too large, but you do have to coordinate with others who are tackling other areas so that collectively we can actually do this job. So there's a lot of hope. I'm not at all negative about it, or I mean, I'm just clearly, I just like to understand what I'm dealing with, but I'm not pessimistic in any way. I just like to tell people that exude positivism, because that's what's going to take here to get around.
Mm-hmm.
So now with the poultry, the process was pretty straightforward. Here's what I found. People are the problem, not the chickens, not the cows, not the pigs. We are the problem. We are the ones who brought them into confinement. We are the ones who then concentrate all that manure, which then leaks into the creeks. We are the ones who put, you know, land tile to drain the water, the beautiful water that falls into our landscape across the 12 states in the Midwest. We tile the land. And it,
wow, I love your whole vision. It's like, I have been saying to everybody for the longest time, but, you know, I'm just carrying the message, and I don't have the system in place to implement it. But, you know, it's just intolerable that we have a multi-tiered, divided, delivery of food and nutrition to people. It is so fundamentally, you know, not the way to go. And so my dream has always been that food be the ground, basic grounded right, you know, for everybody, and in this kind of model. So because I've seen, you know, all that evolves in terms of people's health and their life and everything through not having it. And if we're going to talk about how fundamental food and nutrition is from the health side, as I have done for so many years, then we have to equally assure that the society is valuing and supporting.
Yeah, and the truth is we have to mobilize quite a lot of resources, and there is no better resources than those directly coming from the people, the individuals out there who want to change the world. And unfortunately, it's not corporations or foundations that want to change the world. It is the people, and their resources are critical. And for that, we have to have integrity ourselves. I don't feel good about raising money for nonprofits in general, because there's so much illegitimacy there. And I keep telling this to our teams, and, you know, and legitimacy, not as in they got bad intentions or they are corrupt or any of that. I mean, there may be some of that too, but legitimacy as to have we actually understood how we're going to create change before we start going out and raising money for ideas and projects and stuff, and then further distracting and utilizing and deviating resources that could actually go to real solutions. That kind of thinking is what I have been doing, and trying to hold other nonprofits accountable so that we actually stay on track. And this is how I plan to do it, by example and all of that. I mean, my nonprofit is just one more of those efforts. And we can have integrity, but we have to be just as aware of our nonprofits' lack of integrity as a sector, just like the corporations, and you know, so that we can actually continuously detoxify ourselves from our own colonized approaches.
Hinaldo, tell us, what is the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance that you are the president of, and, you know, what is it that you're doing, and what are your goals?
Well, first of all, it is a 501c3 tax-exempt nonprofit, and the primary goal of the alliance is to work on consolidating supply chain. So with having said that, supply chain to us really means, you know, bringing regenerative poultry into a larger scale system level deployment. And now the reason it's an alliance rather than a, you know, regenerative poultry website is because what I was saying before, in relationship to the need to build a consolidated multi-sector effort here, is critical for the success of any individual sector. And so even though the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance's focus is on seeing the supply chain for poultry come alive, the success, our success as an alliance, our success on the poultry is going to result from the ability to align with other sectors that are actually advancing in the regenerative supply chain landscape. And to that end, we're deliberately building partnerships with native raised bison, not just bison or buffalo, but actually native bison, and then pasture pork. And of course, there is already a whole world of grass-fed and finished beef and dairy. And even though it's not that far off the poultry itself, the regenerative grains, in this case, we're talking about grains, mostly small, that are grown with multi-rotational strategies and also in systems that incorporate perennial crops and are done more under an agroforestry design or agroecological design that, you know, moves the grain supply for the poultry away from traditional monoculture. Even though they are the same grains, we can build a more indigenous engineering back into the supply of grain for the poultry so that we consolidate that supply chain all the way from far back through the raising of the poultry itself under the tree canopy system, and then forward to include value-added processing and distribution. Because, you know, regenerative, we get hung up on thinking about regenerative as soil health and crop rotations and things like that. And all of those are definitely important components of a regenerative system. But regenerative system is really mostly about how people are compensated, how people are organized, how they are motivated, all the way from consumers to farmers to workers, and especially how, you know, workers throughout the supply chain are being treated decently, have working conditions that don't make them sick, and so on. It's not, I mean, the animals, sure, and the soil, sure. All of those things are important, but a system is not regenerative just because the soil got better biology as a result of the practices. We can do that in many ways and still not regenerate the social and the economic conditions of farmers. We can still exploit farmers while raising good soil. That's not regenerative. So that's the point on all this linking and building an alliance, is that it allows us to focus on poultry, scale up poultry, do it with integrity and with an indigenous engineering blueprint, but also gives us the ability to work as an industry sector, a regenerative agriculture sector, by linking up and aligning with those other sectors that are also, you know, seeking that same level of integrity. That's really what the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance is in a nutshell.
Wow, that's really a very well thought through and comprehensive approach. And, you know, I think it's really significant and important for people to know about and support for, you know, both for the sake of the poultry and all of that and all that you're intersecting with there. But it's also an important model because, you know, one of the things that as a, you know, media communicator who's dealt with different, you know, sectors of, you know, society and things that people are working on is it's always a tendency among, you know, anyone to want to talk to their peers, you know, whether it's farmers to farmers, doctors to doctors, journalists to journalists, you know, in a way where you know, there's this kind of comfort level and bonding and belonging and deeper dialogue when we're talking to our peers. But one of the things as someone who is more on the consumer side, you know, I'm not actually a farmer or anything like that, and in an urban environment, but speaking to people who eat food, and I hate calling anyone a consumer really because of, you know, when you really think through the combination, I mean, we are part of this whole system which nourishes us and, you know, so I guess one could say the nourished. But, you know, it's really important to see a model of where this is possible beyond and how it has reach and how people can work together to build it in a, you know, more scalable sense than, you know, not to negate all of the work that has been being done on an individual farm by individual farm, but as long as we only have an individual business model, I think it becomes unconvincing to the average person that this could really have a more profound impact in terms of all that it touches than what you're describing. So, it's really, really quite important and brilliant for this to be, that you're doing this. And, we haven't actually touched on, in our discussion of regenerative and all the programs I've done, we haven't really touched on the aspect of the workers, the people who are doing the planting. Traditionally there was organizing for workers, for farm workers, and now there's, a growing consciousness about workers and labor and all of that, across many different areas of endeavor. But could you just, kind of orient our listeners a little bit to what it looks like to have a regenerative labor and management system?
Totally. But also, making sure that everybody understands that there is no such thing as a regenerative chicken or a regenerative vegetable. There is regenerative systems that produce regenerative vegetables or regenerative poultry. That is a very important departing point, and so is true when talking about labor. There is no such thing as a regenerative labor standard, and there should never be, because labor by itself, it cannot be isolated like that. That's called reductionism. Now, focus and reductionism are two very different things, too, separated by an abysmal space. Reductionism puts you back into, okay, let's take care of the workers. But what about the ecology? Well, let's take care of the ecology, but what about the workers? That's reductionism. Now, focus, for example, is focusing on the poultry sector, but holistically as a system. And so within that context, the workers, it starts, and it's not just the workers, let's call it the people, okay? Not consumers, not eaters, not workers, not farmers. Let's call it the people in this poultry system, to give an example, because it's got to happen in all the different tracks of regenerative actual industry beginning. And so in the poultry, I can tell you that the people matter way more than, as a design perspective, way more than even the ecology. And the reason being that it is the people and their inability to see the world from an indigenous perspective that turns good ideas into extractive operations, business operations. And so when we think of it that way, the consumer, let's start from the far end, the people who will eat the products, they deserve a product that is affordable but not cheap. Affordable meaning fairly priced. That means nobody is in the system exaggeratedly or overwhelmingly increasing the cost of that product artificially, whether because they are inefficient producers or whether because they are profiting out of the goodwill of the person who needs that nutrition on one on the opposite end from the land. So that is critical. That is taking care of the people who consume. Then you move it, and you move it one step up, and you say, okay, so for the people to have that food, you need a grocery store or a restaurant or somebody in that close to the to that level that will deliver that product. They also deserve to be treated fairly, and so but also should not have the right to take advantage of the final user of the product just because they have to eat three times a day or because without food and nutrition, they really can't have a life. Because this food is so fundamental to life itself that it should never have been corporatized. It should always be kept as something that, if there is any place where we actually should subsidize the 100% of it, it should be food. So that nobody
should have
to pay necessarily. It should be something that we deliver fully with full nutritional integrity to everybody as a result of a social scheme, not as a result of a capitalist corporate totalitarianism scheme. That is a mistake we made. I think we have to correct that. And so,
agree 100%.
Now, that layer of business is critical, because without those intermediaries, the food doesn't make it all the way to that person at the end. And remember, everybody up the chain, all the way to the lion, also eat. So it's critical that all the way from the farmer to the opposite end, where there are people who are not going to farm, who are going to work on something else, maybe big computers, maybe do sort of things, and somebody else got to produce their food, that the integrity is maintained in terms of how people are taken care of, in terms of their food, so that it's nutritious, so in the price of it, so that it's fair, and in the value added that is generated in the markups, so that everybody can get a little bit of the pie, but not a single conglomerate that takes 90% of the profit and then leaves the rest to starve. And when you create those conditions, people are going to abuse the environment, each other, and create conditions that are not good for anybody. So the people are central, because we take care of the ecology and all of the rest of it, of the system, when we feel happy within that infrastructure and when we feel rewarded. And that reward has to be understood also from a cultural perspective, that reward needs to be balanced. It needs to be controlled. We don't have the mental ability and the cultural background and the historical proof that we can control our greed and our desire and our impetus to take over control and ownership of something that is so essential for human life.
Mm-hmm.
That's the context of taking care of people. And in the same
this
back,
is,
yes,
this is just with. Incredible. I mean, you have just articulated, my dream. Because anything that falls short of that is just... It's fragmented. It's divisive. I mean, right now, people, as we are attempting to regain control of our country from these large entities, who are have bought us and own us and are running the government in a terrible manner. A lot of people will say, well, we can't tell the truth about what's going on here because it's polarizing, and we have to have somebody who's in the middle because of all of the polarization. What you're talking about is the core reason there's polarization. When there are haves and have-nots, when there are people who, can eat the most precisely perfect, clean food of some type, without regard for anyone else in the system, or without regard from the fact that others are deprived of that, and, in a situation of eating extremely poor quality and often quite toxic food, when we're in that dissociation, which we're in, we're in it in every direction, that creates the polarization. And what you're talking about is the healing of the polarization. And I've also identified that for a while and care about that passionately. And, if we created that, the polarization, we'd be on the way to resolving that, because that is so fundamental. I mean, there's nothing more basic than food, water, shelter, air, those very basic things. Without those, we don't really have anything. Now, I want to, say that we're coming to the end of our show and do the show closing. I just want to tell people also that you can learn more by going to and attending or even following the videos, which will be posted on their website, at the Soil and Nutrition Conference. You can find, and Reginaldo will be speaking along with a host of other terrific speakers that we're going to be featuring on different editions of Connect the Dots upcoming. You can find that online at soilandnutrition.org. It'll be taking place November 14th through 17th, 2019 in Southbridge, Massachusetts. Look it up. If you're able to attend, that's great. If not, track it, because videos are always, and they do very good videos of these excellent talks, will be available. If you've enjoyed this show, please share it with others through social media, and you can link to it on the Connect the Dot Archives, where the show will be posted later this afternoon. That's at Connect the Dots, plural, podbean.podbean, podbean.com, and you'll find the show there. Where can people find, learn more and support your work, Reginaldo? Online,
well, first of all, through the through the Regenerative Agriculture Alliance, regenagalliance.org. Get in touch through our contact page there, and that's really the center of all of this. If you go through that, you will find us and me and all of our teams across the country. We have partnerships now in at least 10 regions, with another 5 coming along, including Guatemala, Mexico, British Columbia, Colombia in South America, and regions in Minnesota. Where we are anchored is the southeast region of Minnesota, and also we have partners in Nebraska, in South Dakota, in Iowa, and recently we started exploring our partnerships in the east and the west coast. So we will be able to connect people from all of those areas, and whether you are a nonprofit organization doing food revolution or food insurgency, as I call it, or a farmer or any of those folks out there who are part of taking back this ownership and control of our food system. And I probably, to close, I'll say, you know, I don't think of this as a food revolution. We don't need a food revolution or a regenerative agriculture revolution. What we need is a people insurgency to take back ownership and control of our food system. And insurgencies are organized on a very different set of disciplines, principles, strategies, and tactics. And we need to be beyond, you know, that kind of talk about revolution, but then going back and buying craft food and supporting the corporations that are decimating the planet. Insurgencies don't do that. That's the difference between an insurgency and a revolution. I want to organize, and I want all the folks to help organize a regenerative, agroecological, people-centered insurgency. And then the objective is the ownership and control of our food.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's such a great vision. You know, thank you. I love that. Thank you so. And, you know, it's a whole different thing when it's an insurgency, because you're not just voting or telling other people how to vote. This is yours. You know, this is our food, our earth, our health, our lives, the future of our species and other species, our earth. Thank you so much for, you know, all the work you're doing is just so first rate, and I'm sure we could talk on another 3 programs and unpack some of your learned and applied wisdom in this department, and you know, we'll have to overcome technology or you know, and find a way to do that. We've had a little backstage fussing with that today, but it's so worth it. Thank you, Reginaldo Haslett Morakin, you know, for your wonderful initiatives and wisdom on all of this, and for sharing that with me and with the listeners to connect the dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Heads up, everyone. Keep marching tall in company of all our relations. Yeah.